they can hope to maintain on the land of their ancestors.
Okay, Huwaida, I'm going to get to the International Court of Justice and the international community's reaction to that later. I wanted to ask you, why is Israel, I mean, given that a lot of countries, including the United States, have criticized the construction of the wall within the West Bank on occupied lands, why is it doing it? Why isn't not simply erecting a wall on the Green Line or the 1967 border?
Well, the simple answer to that is that in Israeli, the Israeli government has continued throughout the years to operate on this notion of a greater Israel, where they consider the occupied territories to be part of greater Israel. Now, their problem is, what do they do with the indigenous Palestinian people? And so the path of this wall further proves that the Israeli government wants the land, but without the people. And so as much as they can ethnically cleanse the people from these areas by completely isolating them, when you build a concrete wall around a village or around a city and completely cut off the inhabitants, farmers, from their farmland and from water wells and from their source of existence, it becomes very hard to stay in areas. When someone needs permission to go to the next, to exit from an iron gate to get out of this, their own village, to go to the city, next city over, to get medical care or to go to school, it becomes very tiresome and almost impossible. And so I think the hope is that the Palestinians will tire of this kind of life and to have them go through these procedures and will move. And so the path of the wall, how it's drawn, is precisely to do just that, to get Palestinians, to confine them in the tightest spaces possible so the Israeli state can have as much land as possible. And that's, for example, where they've already built the wall, up near the northern part of the West Bank, some of the most fertile, or the most fertile land in Palestine. All of these farmers, all of their farmland is isolated from them. They have to go through this wall now to get to it, and they have to apply for permission, which is frequently denied to them. And so what happens? They can't get to their land anymore, and they stop going to their land. And according to Israeli state law, land that is not tended to for 3 years is considered abandoned and can be used for state purposes. And this is exactly what's going to happen if this is allowed to continue.
So have you heard of people, because I think there's going to be over 100,000 people who would be either cut off from their land or encircled behind the wall in Qalqilia and the other northern cities and villages. Have you heard of the people? Is there an exodus? Are people leaving or trying to leave because of the situation, the economic situation, the deprivation of, you know, freedom to movement, freedom to tend to their fields? Are people leaving? I mean, is this working?
Well, so far, thankfully not. A lot of people recognize this is the Israeli military and government strategy and are trying to do the utmost to stay. Like a village that we've been working very closely with over the past couple of months in the region of Ramallah. It's a village called Budrus. It's home to about 1,200 Palestinians. The Israeli military just started work there a little less than 2 months ago, started uprooting trees, and the villagers have been persistent in demonstrating and organizing, and every time they see those bulldozers, to get down and put their bodies in front of those bulldozers to stop the work, to stop the destruction of their land, and in any way possible get their voices heard in the international community. And on top of that, on top of this kind of village action and mobilization, they are, sadly, they're not optimistic. The work did stop there for a while, we think possibly in response to the increased media attention of the action of these villagers and having internationals and Israelis join their protest. But the villagers are under no kind of misconception, or they're not being overly idealist or optimistic in thinking that the wall won't go up, just because history has shown that even the most atrocious things you can imagine have happened here, And you think that the world wouldn't let it happen, but it does. And so they recognize and they've seen their fellow Palestinians in other areas that are already encircled by the wall. And so they're making plans for that. Because it's a small village, they depend on the neighboring city of Ramallah for a school, for work, for a hospital. And so they're trying to establish a clinic in their village. They're trying to get a local university to open a branch also nearby in the next village over, so that their students won't decide to leave, so that people that need medical care won't go and move into the city, so that people will stay on their land. So these kind of preparations are also being made. So I hope we won't see this mass exodus, but you know, that's the optimistic voice in me speaking, that people are trying to make preparations for that, in addition to hoping that the international community hears their cries and does not let this wall project continue.
Okay. Haaretz correspondent Gedeon Levy, I believe, recently wrote a feature on Budrus, citing it as a example of Palestinian nonviolent resistance to the occupation and successful nonviolent resistance. From what I read, the construction did stop, and people were kind of gaining some hope. But how much attention did it attract in Israel? And because I don't recall hearing anything about Budrus or what was happening in Budrus in Canada in any of the Canadian mainstream, you know, newspapers or any coverage. How much attraction did it attract? I mean, if you're following what's kind of the coverage, international coverage about what's going on in Budrus.
Well, sadly, it's not. I mean, Gideon Levy is very unique when it comes to Israeli journalists. There's also another great Israeli journalist by the name of Amira Haas. Mm-hmm. Now, these two do get to the crux of the issue here, do write about the occupation. Unfortunately, they write for a left-leaning Israeli paper that is not very widely read. In fact, possibly their internet edition in English is read more than the Hebrew edition here by Israelis. So there hasn't been too much attention in the Israeli media. And the attention that there is overwhelmed by the propaganda of Palestinians being terrorists. It's very psychological in Israeli society. You get them to fear. You get them to fear their neighbors, and then they will justify or stay silent in the face of their government actions. And that is what happens. And sadly, the international mainstream media also doesn't focus on the crux of the problem here, on the various means of Palestinian resistance, quite frankly, because they see violence and blood as being more newsworthy. Mm-hmm. And we know from our experience here, when we talk to journalists, and when we talk to them about the different mobilizations and the actions and various nonviolent actions being planned, there is not that much interest there. We hope to change that, and we will keep working. And once or twice you're ignored, and then, you know, if you're persistent, you hope that someone listens. So it's not, you probably won't hear about it soon in the Canadian mainstream media. But that doesn't mean that we're going to stop here. And we know that Canadian and other activists that come here, even if the mainstream media doesn't cover it, these committed individuals, concerned individuals, will take the footage and the pictures and the stories home and will spread the information person to person, because we need to try all avenues. What's happening to the Palestinian people, again, I say the crux of the problem. We hear of violence all the time. We hear about the cycle of violence, but no one actually pays attention to the root cause of the violence, which is the occupation and occupation policies that continue to daily deny Palestinians basic human rights, human dignity, right to life. And that, of course, is violence in itself, and there is a reaction to that. And so we see in the media this a terrible cycle of violence, but we want to end it. We have to address the root cause, and we have to mobilize to end the occupation. And that's where the international community and all of the governments signatory to the Fourth Geneva Conventions have failed, and they have failed to live up to their obligations to uphold UN resolutions and international law. And for the longest time, Palestinian civilians and communities have been left all alone to resist this massive military force. And again, this is why the international solidarity movement was founded, to say no and to create a resource for the Palestinian nonviolent resistance. And in a sense, so concerned civilians from all over the world can step up to do what their respective governments have not been doing.
Okay, Huwaida, I want to ask you, you mentioned that we have to address the root of the violence, which is the occupation. Now, some people might answer and say there was a nonviolent struggle in the First Intifada, and which ended in 1993 with the signing of the Oslo Declaration. And over the next years, Israel withdrew from portions of the West Bank. So, you know, there was a track of negotiations that was open, and which could have conceivably led to an end of the end of the occupation. So people are using this argument to reject the notion of the root causes of the Intifada and say the root causes could have been addressed through negotiations. What do you think of that?
Sadly, most people, Israelis first of all, and also the international community, has been misled by this. Right, there was Oslo that was signed in 1993, and people were happy, and there was a lot of fanfare and the signing of the Oslo Accords on the White House lawn. It was September 13th, between the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Chairman of the Palestinian Liberation Organization Yasser Arafat, and the world thought or hailed this entering into a new era of peace in the Middle East. But what happened after that, for the 7 years following, was anything but moving towards peace and an end of occupation for the Palestinian people. Actually, quite the opposite. What happened was there was a cementing of the occupation under the guise of peace and a peace process. The checkpoints and roadblocks were established in this period of the Oslo Peace Accords. So Palestinian, actually, freedom of movement was, restriction on Palestinian freedom of movement was intensified in this time period. The Gaza became completely closed off with the establishment of the Erez checkpoint after the signing of Oslo. Palestinian land continued to be confiscated for the building of settlements, which, according to Oslo, settlements were supposed to be dismantled, but more and more land continued to be confiscated from Palestinians to build settlements. Actually, the number of settlers between 1993 and 2000 doubled from 200,000 to 400,000. And Oslo said that the settlers were all supposed to, and more Palestinian land was confiscated and raised to build Jewish-only roads to connect these settlements. And so if you're supposed to dismantle these settlements, why build roads for these Jewish-only colonies? Palestinian homes continue to be demolished in Jerusalem. All of these steps got the Palestinians thinking, if we're supposed to be in a peace process, why these unilateral actions that are in essence a violation of the accord we just signed? And whenever they would protest, they would be silenced because, you know, we're in this peace process and we'll work it out. But it became obvious that Israel was cementing the occupation and maintaining control to make sure that there wouldn't be an establishment of a viable independent Palestinian state. And it erupted in Palestinians saying, no more, this is not peace, in the end of September 2000. And Palestinians began demanding true freedom, a true end to the occupation, not a facade. That's actually what happened. And even, you know, after the there was the Camp David Accords, which you greatly talked about, July 2000, right before the outbreak of the Intifada, this latest Intifada. If one would read the Camp David Accords, you would see that Israel sought to maintain complete control over Palestinian airspace, Palestinian borders, Palestinian relations with other countries, Palestinian water. Israel controls all of the water resources here and greatly denies Palestinians this, you know, essential element for living. It restricts Palestinian water, and they were not about to negotiate on any of this. So there could have, with the deal that was on the table, it wasn't peace. And what the Palestinian people decided is they weren't going to play along. They were demanding true freedom from Israeli occupation and calling on the international community to recognize that they couldn't, they can't live like this. That's really what happened with the whole Oslo peace process, with the Camp David Accords, and now the Palestinians, with the Palestinian freedom struggle, and what are they?
Huwaida, I don't know if you can hear me. I think we just lost Huwaida.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you now. We found her. Sorry, was that your mobile?
I can hear you okay.
Oh, okay. I can hear you fine.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm sorry, you were saying?
As I was saying is the whole Oslo peace process, actually the actions of the Israeli government did anything but move the Palestinians and Israelis closer to an end to the occupation and the development of peace relations between an independent Palestinian state and an independent Israeli state. Because under this guise of peace, the Israeli military and government, which is in fact stronger, and there's no check on on Israeli actions. There's no mechanism to hold Israel accountable for adhering to previously signed agreements or adhering to international law, which is why Israel continues to be in violation of countless UN resolutions. There's no mechanism to hold Israel accountable. And so during these Oslo years, these 7 years, they actually cemented the occupation by continuing to confiscate Palestinian land, building settlements, moving settlers into these Jewish-only colonies, demolishing Palestinian homes, and moving ahead with their policy of ethnically cleansing Palestinians to hold on to the land but get rid of the people. That wasn't peace, but that is what this is the period that to the international community was known as the Oslo peace process. But to the Palestinians here, it was a very organized, systematic method of continuing to remove them from the. And in September 2000, they said, enough, enough. And they took to the streets in protest over what was happening. And the Israeli military responded with live ammunition and massive military force. And now we see this terrible cycle of violence where people are being attacked. The root of their existence is daily attacked, and a small minority feel like the only way they can fight back is also using violent methods. The majority of the Palestinian people are calling on the international community to live up to their obligations to the Palestinian people and to not allow it to happen. And this is what our message also to the international community is, that Palestinians deserve a freedom. Their freedom and an end to this occupation. And Israel is not going to give it up alone, that the international community needs to stop paying lip service to freedom and human rights and democracy and actually needs to act to immediately impose restrictions upon Israel and pressure to make Israel comply with already established UN Security Council resolutions. They must pull out of the occupied Palestinian territories.
Okay, now, since the outbreak of the Intifada, the United States has pushed forward several new frameworks that are based more or less on the Oslo understandings, including the Mitchell Report, the Tenet Plan, more recently the roadmap. Now, in Canada, when the Foreign Minister, Bill Graham, was asked why the Canadian government opposed taking the matter of the fence or the wall or the separation barrier to the International Court of Justice, he responded that there are already pre-existing negotiations taking place. I think he was referring to the roadmap, and we should keep the conflict political and within this track. Do you think that guarantees that we're going to be seeing more of the same over the next few years?
Sadly, this is a very shameful response, because if I'm going to tell you what happens here, the Palestinian people and the Palestinian leadership are very desperate for anything that will help them. And so they have accepted over the years the Mitchell Plan and the Tenet Report and the roadmap They have accepted these because they want the international community involved somehow in stopping this Israeli aggression. Although all of the plans that are on the table are not sufficient, and they don't even meet the minimum requirements guaranteed to Palestinians by international law. But yet the Palestinians feel like they must start somewhere, and they must get the international community involved somehow. And so they've almost immediately accepted all of these plans. Israel has been the Israeli government has been the one to always stall and to always seek to change. And this is what I'm saying when I say there's no mechanism of implementation. Even in the end, after Israel submits all of its objections and then pays lip service to, for example, the roadmap, they don't implement. And there's no mechanism in place to make Israel implement. Now, with regards to the International Court of Justice, it cannot be allowed to stand that there are plans or there's a roadmap on the table, because already Israel's not intent on implementing or abiding by the roadmap, and they'll continue to stall. And this wall, while as far as Israeli strategy is concerned, of a land grab, it is political. But as far as violations of human rights goes, it's very much a humanitarian issue and an issue of Palestinian human rights that the International Court of Justice must take a stand on and must not allow these human rights violations to continue while we talk about, you know, a roadmap that Israel may or may not decide to adhere to.
But do you think that if, you know, the Canada, the U.S., the EU, and Russia get their way, along with Israel, of course, and the issue is not heard before the International Court, I mean, is there a hope of ending this violence or cycle of violence, ending the occupation which, provokes this violence without internationalizing this issue, without bringing in more parties to the table, apart from, you know, the triangle of Israel, the United States, and, the Palestinian representatives. Would there be any possibility of doing this, so long as people don't step in and, you know, come up with new reference points, perhaps, for ending the conflict?
Well, I'll tell you, Samet, it's very dangerous on a couple of fronts. The first is the message that it's sending to the Palestinian people here that, you know, their lives and their rights are worth nothing, because this wall is completely cutting people off from their livelihood, their very means of existence. Farmers that have known nothing but their land, their farmland for ages and generations, now have been cut off from this and are looking at how they're going to feed their families and how they're going to survive.
I think we're having some problems with Huwaida's cell phone. Huwaida, can you still hear me? Okay, we're...
Hello?
Yeah, are you... Okay.
You hear me okay? I'm sorry
It's fine. No, it's totally fine. Yeah, we hear you okay.
Bad line. I'll try to make it short.
It's okay.
It is dangerous. This is going to send a bad message to the Palestinian people that their lives and their human rights are worth nothing. To the people to the Israeli peace activists and the Palestinians that have been working on peace building and relations and justice and an end to the occupation, and for those Israeli peace activists that are also calling on the world to step up and stop this wall. Actually, the area of cooperation that we have seen the most, we've seen the most cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians over the past couple of years is trying to stop this wall. And they have been using various forms of working together in various forms of nonviolent resistance. And if the international community doesn't pay attention to that, they send the message that it's only violence that gets the attention. Mm-hmm. It's only violence that spurs people to action. That is the wrong message. And as far as I can tell you, I can speak for myself and the communities that I work with in the international solidarity movement. We know that for the longest time, the international community has taken a shameful stance as far as Palestinian human rights are concerned and Palestinian right to live in freedom. But the people all over the world, the average people that can be awakened to what's happening here, we know that they wouldn't stand for it, and we've seen it. We've seen hundreds and thousands of people mobilize when they see the true nature of what's happening here and saying, no, I will not stay silent as these massive violations of human rights continue to be carried out with either my government's active support or at least my government's silence. And so even if there is, even if the International Court of Justice does not come back with a satisfactory ruling or decides not to rule on this, we will keep mobilizing here. And someday, I am convinced someday, these governments, these countries that took these shameful positions will look back and feel ashamed that they stayed silent while all of this was taking place. And it is only their citizens that are awakened and that care and decide not to stay silent that will be able to say that we tried to tell you and we told you so, and the world has stayed silent for too long. So we'll continue to work here and hope that Israeli political pressure and sadly also U.S. political pressure that does not represent the American people does not win out this February 23rd.
Huera?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you just cut off there for a moment. Well, one thing that people in Israel are drawing parallels between are the upcoming hearings on the wall and the International Court of Justice's ruling on Namibia in 1971, which is seen as having started or launched really the anti-apartheid campaign or put it out in the international forum. So, which took years, of course, and decades of anti-apartheid activism to bring across and to bring across this awareness. And 30 years later, it paid off, I guess, or if you're looking at it in retrospect. So, what's ISM? Is this a focus now that ISM is working on? Is it mostly communities afflicted by the wall? Okay, I think we've lost Hueda again. Well, Hueda was talking to us from a mobile phone in the West Bank, which are plentiful in the West Bank, but notorious for their bad signal. So, you're listening to the Palestine Corner, and I'm your host today, Samer Latrush, filling in for regular Joseph Lamele, every Monday at 11 o'clock. Tune in next week and upcoming announcements. Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights will be hosting a lecture by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti on March 3rd at 7 o'clock in room H110 in Concordia's Hall building. Also, to stay tuned or check out SPHR's website, www.solidarityforpalestinianhumanrights.com, SPHR.com. For the latest in their ongoing campaign to draw attention to the humanitarian consequences of the separation wall that is being constructed in the West Bank. Thank you for listening to today's show.
You're knocking on the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station. You're listening to the coolest station in Montreal, 90.3 FM on your dial. The alternative station, the one that gives you a choice and a voice. CKUT. Stay tuned.
Le Quoi Palestinien, Le coin palestinien.
The Palestinian radio program from Montreal.
Every Monday from 11:30 a.m. to 12 o'clock noon. Chaque lundi de